Women make up 70% of the healthcare workforce, but only 20% of its leadership. On Her Story, we'll explore the careers of bold and influential women from Silicon Valley to Capitol Hill and learn how they've overcome the odds. I'm your host, Sanjula Jain, and this is Her Story, a program where we explore what's beyond the glass ceiling. Well, it's my pleasure to welcome Dr. Vineeth Arora, who's the newly appointed Dean of Medical Education and Professor of Medicine at the University of Chicago Pritzker School of Medicine. Vineeth, thanks for joining us.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you back as part two of this Her Story series. I know you're one of our first guests in season one with our guest host, Cece, and it's great to follow up with you on this most recent announcement of your newly appointed role, which we're excited to dig into. I know one of the things that you talked a lot about in your first interview was your origins in medicine and the path turning out from chief resident to now dean, and we'll talk about that in a second. Tell us a little bit about where the passion for medicine came from. I know it's highly personal to you.
I think everybody has a different calling for medicine. And I think the calling is very important right now, especially in the pandemic, because you don't enter these jobs because of the money only or because of fame or prestige. Like, we've really seen that you've got to have this intrinsic calling. And for me, that started with my family. My brother has spina bifida, and so I really grew up as on the other side of the doctor-patient relationship as the caregiver and the family member. And so growing up as a child of immigrants who were not doctors and realizing that there was something missing. Whenever they came home from a doctor's appointment, there were so many questions, but the way they idolized doctors and the way doctors were so important to my brother's health and welfare was also really impressive, particularly at times when he needed emergency care or needed life-saving care. And so those were all things that really inspired me growing up to really think about this field, because I always was attracted to science and math and sort of STEM oriented, but this field had the opportunity to really make a big impact on patient lives. And so that's what really inspired me.
And what's really unique about your path is you've been pretty early on passionate about this area of medical education. Where did that interest come from?
Yeah, that's sort of interesting. I would say that I think starting with those early kitchen table conversations with my parents, trying to understand what it is that the doctor said, you realize the power of education and the power of communication, particularly. I mean, education really is, how do we communicate these very complex concepts? How do we train the doctors of the future? I would say that I got more interested in teaching when I was at Johns Hopkins as an undergraduate. I worked several jobs, and one of the jobs that I worked was as a tutor. And so I had that sort of passion for simplifying concepts. So how do we break it down and simplify it for other people? Interestingly, my other job that I had was raising money for the university. And so I'm leaning on both of those skills right now. And so you never know, the jobs that you hold, like those skills might come back to you to help you later. So I knew that I had that experience and I really enjoyed tutoring. People thought I was good at it. So I thought, okay, let me continue this. So in medical school, I was probably fairly unusual in nowadays. I held a job during medical school. It was a little bit more common at that time, but not common, but it was not unusual. And so I continued to tutor and I taught for the MCAT. And so I was like, okay, well, again, I was always grown up with this idea of what can you do to make a difference? And given that I did not come from a family of immense wealth, where I could help offset those personal expenses in medical school really did matter. Those things really, really mattered. So I took up a job teaching MCAT for pre-meds at WashU in St. Louis. So I kept going with the teaching. And then I realized when I got to residency that there was a potential career out of this. I didn't really know that going into residency, but then I saw mentors like my program director, Dr. Holly Humphrey, sort of make a career out of teaching in medical education. And that was very inspiring. And I had not ever seen that before. I'd only been exposed to really research or clinical practice. And so I started to learn more about that. And that's sort of what inspired me to really continue down this path, if you will.
Wow, that's fascinating. It's fun to see some of that come full circle for you. I know, as you know, we like to ask all of our guests how you think about your foray into healthcare leadership, which is a little bit different from the early days of clinical practice exclusively. Your answer was quite interesting, right? You said it was a little bit accidental from like a publication point of view, but then in some ways it was intentional, and you've got a great story about your raising your hand for chief resident. Tell us a little bit about that entrance into leadership, and then more specifically, how you've thought about the most recent 3 to 5 years and this path to this new role that you're on.
Yeah, so I would say, I think that I'm on a Facebook group of physician women leaders, and it's interesting how accidental leadership does happen, because I think what happens is if you're good at what you do and you like everything. So I'm a generalist and I invest a lot in what I do and I like everything. Those are the types of things that end up then being valued at the leadership level, because you can sort of relate to a lot of different things. And so as opposed to being a specialist where I was really narrowly good at one thing, I sort of dabbled in a lot of different things. And so I think that was interesting in the sense that sometimes that's not rewarded in academia, but it's very valued in leadership. And when I think about my own path, I certainly think about those early days as a chief resident. Actually, my first leadership position ever was actually president of our high school band. And so I mentioned that because high school bands are made of musicians, and this was a marching band. So this is personalities, fiefdoms, flutists and clarinetists and trumpet, brass, percussion, very different personalities, but they all come together and they produce great music together and great routines and amazing pride and create a community. And so I ended up being elected as president of the band, partly because I had volunteered to serve as a student government representative, and no one in the band wanted to do this, but I was sort of interested in it. I've always had an interest in policy and representation and advocacy. So I thought, okay, well, this is my opportunity to understand how to make the school better. So because I volunteered for that, I would give the report outs because it was second period, I would give the report outs to student government. And I feel that is why my band conductor was like, you should run for president. And initially I was like, that sounds odd, because usually the president was the most talented musician. And I'll be honest, I was not the most talented musician.
What instrument did you play? I have to ask.
I played the clarinet and I enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it, but I was not, I took lessons. It took hard work, but I was not naturally gifted. I had people of this band went on to major in music in college, and I stopped playing after I left high school. But as a band president, you realize the need to really appeal to everybody and take in everyone's opinion and make sure that you were representing people's needs and views, and also getting great ideas. So I think about a lot of those things now, because it sounds corny, but those were early experiences that really shaped who I am today. And they don't have anything to do with medical leadership. They're really just emotional intelligence, if you will. And so I think a lot about that when I think about medical students and residents. We see a lot of people who've had team experiences. Athletes do very well and become leaders because of those similar experiences. And so while I wasn't athletically gifted or musically talented, I found an avenue for myself. And so I think that is an important thing to highlight. And medicine, the career in medicine is very long. Burnout is the norm. I mean, it's not, we should say, you will burn out. You will have burnout. That is an occupational hazard of our profession. Should it be that way? It shouldn't. But that's something that we need to be to reconcile, is that the current environment is that this is the case. But I always say to the students and residents, what are some of the things that really give you joy that I can keep talking about when we're working together? And so I remember working with one intern during Christmas one year who was very burned out early in my career, and he was really interested in preventive medicine. And of course, we were now he's on his fourth inpatient month and dealing with all the ills of hospital care. And so I ended up saying, hey, let's talk about preventive medicine. This new article came out, and find out what allows people to continue their passion and allow them to continue going with it. And so I think that's what leaders do, right? Leaders help people really grow. So I would say that my experiences early on, but also later as a research mentor, my path was a little bit circuitous because I did do a lot of research, but as a mentor and a teacher, I ended up really realizing the thing that I loved most about research was mentoring. And what do I love about mentoring? It's really growing somebody to become that independent thinker in research. Those are all things that I bring to the leadership table. Every day I think about those things when I meet with meet with a faculty member all the way to a pre-med student.
That's so well said. And I think one of the reasons that we thought about envisioning the special series is exactly that, to highlight these very unique backgrounds, both coming into medicine, but also what you can do being trained as a clinician, right? That you don't have to just have the traditional job that we think exists. And so I'm curious, even in your current role, how do you think about exposing students to these different career paths within medicine, right? It could be patient frontlines with patients. It could be the administrative leadership side. It could be in the media side. Like, how do you think about that?
Yeah, I would say we have a long way to go. So that's one of my passions, because I think that our medical education curricula is fairly static. And so we've sort of languished on this, let's do multiple choice questions and high stakes testing. And then we'll just immerse people into the wards and see what sticks. I think we could be doing a much, much better job with how we train our health professionals of the future, and particularly in passionate about physicians. I would say that one of the things that we know for physicians is many times they actually are serving on teams and serving as leaders of teams or helping teams grow. And so, great example. What's the teamwork competencies that they're getting? How do we, some of the things that I know, I went to public policy school. And so I had some of this exposure to sort of running a team and how do you manage diverse voices? Those are not typical things that are taught in medical school, conflict management and negotiation. And I think those are the same things where women in medicine suffer too, because we never learned those things. And so back to your question about exposure, I think that a lot of it is about coaching and mentorship, and then deliberate exposure to well-functioning teams and practices that allow people to decide, is this something that I want to be doing or not? At the same time, that it's not a shadowing experience. So I think that when I think about shadowing, I think about high school students or college students, but for medical students, we really need to be thinking about them as adults. And the pandemic has shown that. I mean, the AMA issued a call for health system science impact challenge for medical students and residents. Over 100 great ideas submitted of people in their organizations, medical students leading change, getting PPE, helping with literature reviews, offloading certain activities. Even I read a recent article about medical students helping with loneliness in the community by doing those calls, telemedicine. A lot of our own medical students did man telemedicine lines. These are all early preclinical medical students. We dwell a lot in medicine on scope of practice and supervision, but at the same time, I'm like, we're not utilizing our medical students in a way that really respects that they are adult learners and could be contributing to the health system. And so those are some of the things that we are hoping to do here now at Pritzker. And we just launched this new curriculum evolution process. And so we are evolving our curriculum to really try to keep pace with all the changes that have happened. And I'm very excited about the process and about the co-creation. We've invited our students and our faculty and our alumni and others to contribute, to say, what ideas should we bring to the forefront? And do you want to help? So I do think that we are at an opportunity. We have a huge opportunity. Another big area that we need to address is anti-racism and DEI issues, particularly given the issues that medical education was one of the areas that had the most barriers to entry, particularly for Black physicians, and prevented good care for Black patients. We need to reckon with that. We need to figure out, how do we make amends for that? The fact that the Flexner Report closed all but two Black medical schools in the United States. And so those are some of the things that I think about and lose sleep over, honestly, on a daily basis, as, you know, things that we must be thinking about doing and exposing our students and inspiring them to be part of the change.
Your passion for this area is so evident. It's really palpable. And so thank you for all that you do. I think one of the unique things about you from my vantage point is not being a clinician is you were one of the first to, in some ways, take the national stage through social media and start voicing a lot of these issues and raising awareness and educating both those in the medical community, but those beyond that. How do you view social media and some of those platforms as key to your mission as you work to really permeate some of these longstanding traditions in medical education?
Yeah, no, thank you. That's a great question. And it reminds me also of, I started on Twitter in 2009. And why did I start? Well, curiosity. I have one of my really close friends from Johns Hopkins. My college roommate is in health IT. And she was like, you've got so many great ideas. You're doing all this great stuff. You should join Twitter. And I was like, I don't even know what Twitter is. And so I had a Twitter mentor, a twenter, who helped me get on Twitter. And then all I did was lurk for a while because I was scared. I was like, I don't want to say anything in the wide open. I mean, in medicine, I mean, that's like heretical that you're going to talk about your career on a platform like that in 2009. And I was junior at the time. I was still an assistant professor, I think. And I ended up just lurking for a while. I lurked and I learned. And I realized that there was a space because I remember seeing people mixing up, confusing what students and residents were. Like they would be like, oh, they'd refer to an article and they'd be like, oh, this medical student. But when you read, it's like a resident physician. Or at that time, people were, even now, but at that time, duty hours and resident fatigue and sleep was a big issue. And I had done a lot of research in the area and people always had one view or the other, like the public, but didn't see both sides of the equation. And so I realized that there was a potential opportunity there to educate the public. So I actually, as a lot of people ask me, did I take to social media to educate my students or my residents? And I was like, no, because they're unfortunately with me in person. I have to deal with me, like in the room. And I would never be like, oh, go get on Twitter and follow me to see what I said. But I realized there was this community of people who I would never have reached, who I can actually highlight some of the issues that we're facing in medical education. So I started tweeting about medical education under the handle Future Docs in 2009. I did not tell anybody in my organization I was doing this. I did look at the policies, but like I didn't have it in my handle. If you found me because you were on Twitter, okay. But you're on Twitter too. So that's embarrassing for you as well. So that was my philosophy, which is that if you stumble upon me and find me and then try to catch for my organization, I'll be like, well, what were you doing there? And so it's interesting how my career has grown with Twitter because it was not accepted at the time. And then it grew to become accepted. And then it's grown to be vital. I mean, it's been vital in the pandemic. But like with all things, it's like real life, right? What was interesting about early Twitter is early Twitter was this place where you could connect with people like really across great geographic distance, as well as across profession to be like, oh, let me learn more about each other. And right now, I think, unfortunately, it's become a little bit more of an echo chamber. And it provides a different function. It probably provides a supporting function. Students and residents, faculty, med Twitter has taken a life on its own. It's not as easy now to connect with people in different spaces. So I do worry that it's become increasingly polarized. And certainly there are costs for engaging. You can get attacked and harassed. And we've done research into that, especially if you're a woman, it's even worse. But at the same time, it's an important component of our society because what I would say is that social media is an extension of real life. All the bad things that happen in real life are now happening on social media. And unfortunately that you can't protect that. And that's why as long as our patients are there and our learners are there, we need to be there too, to engage and better understand. But it is interesting in the sense that Twitter is just one platform. There's Instagram now, there's Clubhouse, so many different others. Early Clubhouse now reminds me of early Twitter. And what will it become? Right now, it's very civil, usually a lot of connecting. I can walk into a room on Japanese anime and listen in and ask a question. I don't know that that'll feel so comfortable in the future. So it's our job to really be good stewards and think about that. And so I will say that I think a lot of our students and residents do have to learn about this because social media is also an important extension of their professional identity, particularly in getting a job like on LinkedIn. Are you on LinkedIn? Are you connected with others? So there is pros and cons with all these technologies and we need to be teaching about them as well.
I love that you've created this movement around it, because to your point, it's the world that we live in now. And so I think there are many women out there who are experiencing a little bit of that hesitation of, should I be putting my voice out there? Is it worth, you know, the additional time that that's meant to be? But it's almost like if you don't exist there, you don't exist professionally.
Yeah, I mean, I will say it's funny. My husband is not on Twitter, and although he does lurk, so which I learned recently to great chagrin. But it is interesting in the sense that you can have a very successful vital career, but for women in particular, I do think there's something about being on social media that allows for greater connection. Now, having said that, we did the study that showed that women physicians in particular don't get as much bang for their buck in terms of external speaking opportunities and research collaborations. And so again, it's that double-edged sword, right? It's social media was marketed as this great leveler, you know, of the playing field for hierarchy and a way to help especially people advance. And I have been part of saying that's how I advanced. But at the same time, with all technologies, right, and with that mimic real life, there is inherent bias. And so how do we counteract the bias? That's the human element. And so I think these are things that are all very fascinating for me that I have really come to enjoy learning about, but also how to improve. I will say social media for me is also, in my current job, it's been incredible outlet for me to learn, because people, when you, all of a sudden now I have this title and people don't tell me things. It's not like, I mean, I have this great relationship with so many people, but I do sense that there's like this sort of, people get a little stiffer when I walk into a room. And like when I'm in the hospital, I mean, I'm a hospitalist, and my former job, I routinely would round on the workrooms. I was working as associate chief medical officer, so it was germane to be in the hospital doing things. And when I walk into the hospital now, people are like, oh, is everything okay? As if I'm there to check on something. So I do think that unfortunately, as you get to become higher in leadership, you get further away from the front line and the people that you're trying to support. And so for me, social media gives me a little bit of that. What's the pulse of what people nationally are thinking at that level? And how does that impact me here in Chicago? And how should I think about that when I'm preparing remarks, or when I'm thinking about a policy or a change that affects something that's happening? So those are just some of the things that I'm thinking about when I look at social media these days.
Wow. So it's interesting you mentioned that now in this new role, you've noticed a little bit of a shift there. I'm curious. So you are now, most people think about like the first 90 days of a new role. You are what, about day 60 or so, if I got the math right on that. So what has been the most challenging part of taking on this new role and getting adjusted?
It's honestly the most challenging part of any new job is the cadence and putting yourself in the mindset. I mean, so just even being here in this office, talking to you, having fixed up the office, it's that mindset where it's like, okay, this is my job. I am the dean. People call me Dean Aurora, and I'm like, who are you talking about? I still have that imposter syndrome and some distance because it's so new. But so I still remember. I mean, I remember being at a virtual meeting and everyone had to introduce themselves. And I said, well, I am the, and I paused, Dean for Medical Education. So it's still not rolling off my tongue as well as it could. So it's really about your mental mindset and your cadence of your workday. What's your workday look like? What's the right cadence of meetings to be having with people? In a leadership job, you inherit a team. I mean, it's unless you're an entrepreneur and you're bringing your own team, which I've had that experience of creating a team. But in this job, you're inheriting a team. And one of the things that happens when a new leader comes in is people get very nervous about their longevity, about their prospects, about their work, about their value, making sure that they're valued. And so I think that's one of the things that I would say has been not a challenge, but I've really enjoyed having these conversations, but certainly requires dedicated time and thought to cultivating the team, getting in that cadence. How should we be meeting every week, every other week? Is this the right time? Because it's also an opportunity to revisit doing things differently. And so some people on the team are ready for doing things differently, and other people might be like the status quo. And so, and there's also, when you think about it, many different functions of a team and an organization like this that's trying to produce physicians. And so I think about this, there's a four quadrant model. And I think about, well, what are the things that people are ready to turn around? Because they're like, you know what, we need to do things differently. So a lot of times I did this listening tour to understand, where do we have that capacity for change? And then where are we sustaining? Where are we successful that people are nervous that programs are going to be defunded or not be thoughtful about? Those are the things that I want to dispel and say, hey, these are important things that we want to highlight. And so again, it's sort of modeling the culture, supporting the people, and making sure that you yourself have wrapped your head around the role. So those are the three big challenges that I think of every day.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned there's the mindset piece in a new role, and I'm sure you get this all the time, and I see it on my side too, where especially women say, well, whether it's founding a company or taking on a new leadership role, it's like, I don't know how to do that, right? Like I didn't learn to do that. I didn't train to do that. And so where do I start? And so I can't imagine, I haven't checked the literature, but I don't know that there are many books out there that are, you know, like how to be dean of medical education, right? You just figure it out. But I'm curious, like, mindset aside, whether it was more technical skills or just preparing for some of these things, like, did you do anything for yourself in terms of bridging the learning knowledge for you or things that you read or people you talked to? What was that process like?
Absolutely. So leadership is leadership is leadership, right? It doesn't matter where that leadership is. I, as associate CMO in my prior job, I worked for somebody who I still work with today, and he's our chief medical officer. And I remember leaning on him a lot to say, tell me a little bit more about the platform that you have and sort of how you approach your team. And I had a lot of opportunities to learn this directly because I was on his team. And so a lot of times you seek to emulate leaders that you respect. And so for me, that included my former mentors, people that I'd worked for, as well as external people that you admire from afar. I am very close with the CEO of the American College of Physicians, Dr. Darrellyn Moyer, as well as the CEO of the Council of Medical Subspecialty Societies, Dr. Helen Burstyn, who's another speaker at the Women in Medicine Summit. These are women who I believe have really achieved so much, but also they've done it in a way and in a style that I seek to emulate. And so in a collaborative way, that's been very, very effective. And similarly, I thought about, and one thing that my former boss told me was that keep in mind that at the end of the day, your skill set and your expertise is one aspect, but your ability to lead is something that translates across leadership positions. And that gave me a little bit of confidence to go forward. The other thing that gave me great confidence is asking for help, because I have a great team and I also have a great network and I can ask for help. I mean, I can reach out to the dean for medical education at University of Colorado and say, she happens to be an ID physician, and say, what do you think about this COVID thing and students and et cetera? So, and I use those lifelines. I use them on a daily basis. And so don't be afraid to ask for help. And I think that is very important as a new leader, because you're not only asking for help within your team, you're asking for help outside of your team, across your organization, but you're also making new lifelines. And so interestingly, I went, even though I'm at the same organization, I went from working at the hospital to working in the university. And I would say some of the people that have been most helpful to me in the first few weeks of my job were university officials and university lawyers and campus, the folks that really run the campus, the provost office. I had very little insight into what that office does and what they do, other than, you might get a call from the provost if something good happened or something bad happened. But I've come to have a deeper respect for those lifelines. And so I think that's where having those first few days on the job, mapping out, well, who are my go-to people, not just on my team, but outside of my team, because my team might have questions that I cannot answer. And you do not need to be the expert in everything. What you need to do is be the convener and be able to get to an answer that everybody supports, or provide the answer. Sometimes it's an unpopular answer, but provide it in a way that everybody can support it. You know, can you get behind this? And so those have been what's guided me. And I will say every day I'm challenged with something new, and every day I reach out to somebody new and say, hey, I'm new and please help me. Of course, that can feel very uncomfortable. That can feel very uncomfortable, disconcerting, because as a leader, you think I should have all the answers, but it's like being an attending physician. You do not have all the answers for the patient. Sometimes the best answer is, I don't know. That's a great question. Let me do some sleuthing and find the expert and get back to you. And that's leadership. And so that's sometimes what we need to model.
That's really great perspective and really well said. I'm curious then, are you still practicing clinically?
Yeah, I am. I will be on service in October. I'm looking forward to it. Again, I'm looking for ways to maintain a presence in the clinical environment. So I'm doing a lot of case conference, trying to, again, get that cadence right. So what's that cadence of when I'm going to be at resident report, or I'm going to round with the teams, or I'm going to check in with our students. And so I think that having face time with learners is critical in this job. And in my prior job, it was having face time with clinicians. And so they're very similar constituents and sometimes overlapping, for example, in the case of residents. But I'm still figuring out that cadence. And maybe the next time we talk, I'll let you know how my clinical
time. Yeah, I will be interested to hear how that evolves.
I've started to reach out to the chief residents and others to sort of say, okay, how is it going to work? And so I'm going to try it out. And I think it's very important that leaders maintain, physician leaders particularly, maintain their clinical presence, especially in jobs like this. And in our organization, in fact, the only person that does not have a clinical footprint who is a physician is actually the dean of the entire biological sciences division. And so it's pretty unique to not have a clinical footprint. And so I would aim to continue to do something.
That's great. So let's take a step back then in terms of the road to actually getting to the seat that you're sitting in today. As you and I both know, it's less than about 18% of women are deans of medical schools. Then you can break that out further, just generally about women represented in academic medicine leadership roles. What was the process like getting to this specific role? Was it something that you interviewed for? I know you've been with UChicago for quite some time. How did that play out?
That is such an interesting question, because I've spent like 20 years here and assumed this job 20 years to the day I finished residency here. So and sometimes that is overwhelming. And I would say that it's like aging in place, right? There's a very different set of core competencies to survive and succeed in the same organization as to move to a different organization. And so I think when you move to a different organization, and I don't have the experience of this, but seeing others, oftentimes you get a little bit of that honeymoon period where you're the new leader and you're in the learning mode, you're new, you're the shiny new person who's come that people want to meet. When you're in the same organization, sometimes the hardest thing is that you are still doing your old job and people don't even see that you have a new job. And even though they know, it's like, well, of course, she's going to continue to do this. And then the other thing is that you don't necessarily get the honeymoon period because you've got just this overlap. And a lot of people who do leave, actually, well, of course, it's worse because you have to move your family and you're often moving across the country. They will have that break. I've stopped this job and I'm starting this job. I did not have that. It was sort of like this overlap. I was ramping down certain things and ramping up certain things. In terms of so that's a challenge. So I would say that's definitely helped me get the mindset, but it also was overwhelming. It was an incredibly overwhelming period in the spring after it was announced, because I sort of had started being pulled into it right away. And so great example. The academic calendar starts before July 1st. So I was welcoming new residents to the organization. And on the slide, I put the almost dean for medical education, because I'm not the dean for medical education. And I was like, well, here we go. If you're nervous, think about how I feel. And so I think it's good to have that human quality to it, so people understand that you yourself are a work in progress. In terms of the job, they did an internal search for this position. And why did they do an internal search? Likely because a job like this does require a lot of understanding of internal culture, but because we also were in the middle of an accreditation cycle and a lot of other things, sometimes with an external search, as you know, there's high risk for failure and postpone. And they really needed somebody to go with the beginning of the academic calendar. And especially with the pandemic, it was vital that somebody was put in place. So the interesting thing about an internal search is that you're up against your colleagues. And so for this position, they did broad nominations. I think it was like 40 people got nominated and that. So I don't know the exact stats, but there are people in our organization who I don't know, everything was kept very tightly sealed, that have interviewed for this position, who then received that note that I am now the leader and that they either potentially working on my team or are looking to have a role here. And I will say that I've been gifted with an incredible culture where that has been allowed to happen, and it's been very well received. And so I don't feel any ill will from that process, because I think the search was handled so professionally. And so whatever you do, it's more to have a rigorous process. I have participated in external searches, and I have externally looked at things before where I've not gotten the job. And I've also been in an internal search here where I didn't get the job. So I also have had the experience of going up for something, not getting it, and then being part of the team and working with somebody else in that role. And I will say that from above all else, the transparency is what matters most, is that you had an opportunity. And so by listing the position, what you don't want, especially for women, is for this to become like a networking game where it's like, well, who do you think should get this job? Okay, let's talk to them. You want it to be an even playing field where everyone has an opportunity to weigh in and throw their hat in the ring. And that's what I think above all is the transparency is vital. And so we've adopted that model to actually do two faculty director searches that are underway right now. And we've got amazing candidates. I don't know who's going to be the person who are in these roles, but I'm excited about the search. And I'm most of all excited that everybody who has interviewed had the opportunity to throw their hat in the ring, because they will be better for it regardless. And I would say, even for the job I didn't get, I was better at interviewing. I was a better leader because I had that opportunity to interview for the job.
I think as far as throwing your hat in the ring, that's one thing I don't want to gloss over. In your last interview, I think what resonated so clearly was this idea of you rose your hand and you said, you know, pick me with the chief resident consideration, right? I mean, and that's not easy to do. And from everything you're talking about, from finding your voice on social media and trying to encourage, you know, more women in particular to step forward, but just physicians generally, when the search was announced, did you actually intentionally put your name in the hat there, or was it you were nominated, or I'm sure it was a combination of the two, but just to stress the emphasis of you, I presume you actually put yourself in the running there.
Yeah, no, it was a combination of the two. I did receive a note that said I was nominated, which was incredibly humbling. And then I had to think about it, because I have a lab. I was tenured chair professor. I didn't have a bad gig, if you will. I was doing well. And so in some ways, that's sort of the best time to think about a career change, when you're doing well, as opposed to when you're not doing well, because when you're not doing well, your mindset is just clouded by that. And you might make decisions that are rash, because you're like, I need to get out of this current position. And I know that's happened to some people. But in my case, I wasn't, part of me thinks, would I have been okay if I didn't throw my hat in the ring? And I don't know the answer to that, but I did it because I was excited by the opportunity, not because I didn't like what I was doing. And so that I think is very important, because first of all, if you find yourself in a position where you don't like what you're doing, you've got to change that. And there are many ways to think about changing that. But interviewing for a position that's not right for you, or going for a position that you don't think is going to be a good fit for you, that's not the right answer. And so for me, I was in the moment. I had a moment where I could think, do I want to put my hat in the ring? And I could meet with people, mentors and leaders, and say, should I put my hat in the ring? And get those opinions. And I was fortunate in the sense that I've had a lot of experience with research and with publishing and with mentoring, that I sort of felt that I was coming to a natural chapter end, if you will, and that I have, you know, a job like this, I view as you want to make an impact, but it's not like you're going to make an impact like in a week. You're going to make an impact over years and possibly over a decade, 5 to 10 years. And hopefully I'll be lucky. And so that was why I thought about this job, because I thought, well, if I'm ever going to have that impact to really have a platform and really change the way we train future physicians in a positive way to align better with the needs of our nation and our health system and our communities, this was it. And it was the right time for me now with these 10 years. And so that was kind of what I was thinking.
That distinction is really helpful. And Vinny, this has just been such an empowering interview. I have so many more questions to ask, but for the sake of time, I'll probably wrap us up with one or two more. You have accomplished so much and have yet so much more to accomplish, and we're all excited to track your career, but you also wear many hats, right? So you've got your newest hat of dean, and you're have a beautiful family, you're a mom. What advice do you have for other young, I'll focus on physicians for now, women physicians who are juggling more of the unpredictable nature of a, you know, clinical profession and a family?
I thought about this. I think about this a lot. My daughter is, you know, starting school in a few days. My son is 16 months. And so when I took this job, I knew my number one concern was for them. Will I have enough time for them? And my advice to others is that if you see yourself as a leader and going down this path, you will need a team, and you will need a team at work, and you will need a team at home. So I am not Mother of the Year. I am part of an amazing team that provides support for my family and my children. And I had to get more support for my team at home. And so I'm not ashamed to say that. Am I the one who's going to be, you know, always there for my children at 5 o'clock? No, I have 5 o'clock meetings here. I would say as physicians, especially physicians in procedural areas and even clinic, we all know how late clinic goes. Women physicians know that. But as a leader, you can set some boundaries. And so the exciting thing about being a leader is you can create a culture that supports other women. And so a great example is our staff. Our campus staff are coming back from, are switching to more in-person work arrangements after September 8th. But we had an opportunity for everyone to write in what were their needs. And if anyone wanted alternative work arrangements, they could ask for them. And so as a leader, I wanted to be inclusive and say, we understand everyone has different needs. And even the pandemic, it's not like the pandemic's over and everything is okay. People with small children, especially who are unvaccinated, are very vulnerable, especially those that are in jobs that are at the highest echelon of pay grade where they can support nanny and caregivers like I can. And so we, as a school, have adopted a policy of alternative work arrangements for our staff to help support them. And so again, the idea is that, of course, we're here, we're in person, we're supporting our students and our learners, but we have to have some flexibility to allow for people to be part of our workforce. Otherwise, we will not model the same diversity, equity, and inclusion principles that we wish to recruit for. And so that's the trade-off, right? Which is that, yes, I have 5 p.m. meetings, and yes, I have evening things, and I have long days. But the trade-off is, as a leader, sometimes I can set the agenda and the boundaries around those. And I also can use some of the incentives that I receive to help bolster my team at home. And so I will say I have 2 teams, and that team at home is what makes this job possible. And so I have to give a huge credit to my husband and my kids. I mean, honestly, they rise the occasion, as well as everyone who takes care of them.
Wow. Well, that's great advice. And thank you for all that you do. We're excited to see how the new school year goes. And hopefully you'll join us back too. Maybe a year in reflection. But congratulations again on the new role. And I know it's not easy starting it off in the middle of a pandemic, but you're off to a great start.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. And it's great to be here again.
Her Story is a podcast produced by Think Medium. For more leadership stories from inspiring women across healthcare, tune in every Wednesday. Please subscribe to Her Story on Apple Podcasts, YouTube, or wherever you're listening right now.
You can also view Her Story episodes in video and access exclusive content on our website at thinkmedium.com. Be sure to rate and review Her Story so we can continue bringing you insights from influential women across the country. If you enjoyed this episode, we appreciate you spreading the word to your friends, family, colleagues, and mentors who might be interested. For questions and suggestions, please contact us at herstory@thinkmedium.com. Thanks for listening.